From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, what's driving the interest in streetcars around the country?
Then Radio Chipstone visits the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend to explore the exhibition of children's clothing designed by Milwaukee native Florence Eisman.
We meet the woman responsible for the museum's other fashion exhibition, the Radis Collection.
I knew there was a lot of stuff. I didn't know the extent. And so that's when I started to think, this really has to be investigated. There's a lot of fashion history here, but there's a lot of social history.
Plus the importance of bringing children along on trips to other parts of the state, the country, or the world.
Getting out and experiencing it with a different perspective, a different set of eyes, taking a day trip. It's all about getting your kids out there to experience the world around them and expose them to as many things as you can.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. There are many things brewing in downtown Milwaukee. Perhaps the most notable project this summer has been the laying of the tracks for the new Milwaukee streetcar. It's torn up roads throughout downtown and the Third Ward.
Residents have many lingering questions about the new streetcar, but the most persistent one seems to be why. Like many cities, Milwaukee once had a streetcar system that was removed in the 1950s, and that's where interviewer Joy Powers starts her conversation with Yona Freemark, creator of the Transport Politic website.
Yona Freemark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
So just to kind of start off here, Milwaukee used to have a streetcar, actually. But in the 1950s, it stopped operation. And it seems like a lot of cities were this way. They had streetcars and then they didn't. Why did streetcars initially go out of vogue?
You know, you're absolutely right. Cities all over the country had very extensive streetcar systems. In fact, there was a certain period in the 1920s and 1930s when the streetcar was the predominant way of getting around for people in urban America. But in the 1940s and 1950s, there was sort of a movement against the streetcar for a variety of reasons. One was that the streetcars themselves were getting old and people didn't like them very much. And there were buses suddenly available that were cheaper to implement and didn't require things like maintaining the track or maintaining the electric system that powered the trains. So as a result, cities all over the country actually replaced their streetcar lines with bus systems. And the only systems that kept their streetcars were places like San Francisco and New Orleans.
But now we're seeing a lot of cities are going back to the streetcar, cities that have buses. About how many streetcar plans are in the works right now in the U.S.?
You know, there are about a dozen all over the country. Cities that we've seen implement streetcars recently have been Portland, Washington, D.C., Cincinnati, and Kansas City.
And what has the reason been? I mean, we're looking at, you know, the 1950s, and a lot of people are saying, we don't want streetcars, we don't like them, we want buses. And now we're having, you know, the exact opposite situation.
I think, you know, it's almost like the same story told in the opposite direction. In this case, people see buses as sort of old, not very reliable, not very comfortable to be on in many cases. And so as a result, they've seen streetcars as a positive way to get around. And so as a result, you know, these cities think of it as a positive investment to make to improve people's mobility around their cities. They also see it as a way to increase economic development, to build new buildings, especially in their downtowns.
We're going to get back to economic development in just a bit here. But, you know, I've lived in a few different cities, like Boston, where you live. One of the biggest issues I had living in Boston compared to Chicago, compared to New York, was the streetcar. I lived in an area of the city, Brookline, which was between the C line and the D line. And if I could help it, I always went on the D line because it was just faster. It didn't have to deal with traffic. And I think this is an issue that a lot of people who actually use these systems have, which begs the question, why are we seeing so many streetcar plans and not subway plans?
Well, I think you've actually raised a really important point, and this is ultimately the biggest problem with streetcars that are being developed across the country today. We're seeing places like Cincinnati and Kansas City build streetcars that essentially share the lane on the streets that they travel with private automobiles. And that's done because it's essentially cheaper to implement, and it requires less political confrontation between the car drivers and the streetcars themselves. However, that has the negative effect of producing a transit system that actually is not that reliable and can be kind of ineffective for people who want to get around quickly. And that's why there's a difference between different types of rail investment. You can have a streetcar, which is rather slow, which is stuck behind cars in traffic. You can have light rail, which is basically very similar to the streetcar in technology, but completely isolated from that same traffic and therefore able to go more quickly. And then you can have a subway where the train is entirely isolated from traffic and can go as quickly as it wants because it never has to interact with automobiles. The biggest difference between these three options is basically the cost. Streetcars are relatively cheap. Subways are very expensive. And so every city has to figure out which one they can afford and which one makes the most sense for their commutes.
So when we're looking at specifically the Milwaukee streetcar, what is the genesis of that project?
You know, Milwaukee has been looking into the possibility of streetcars for actually more than a decade, I believe. And that's something that's very similar to other cities in the Midwest. You know, as I said before, Cincinnati and Kansas City have streetcar lines, and so does Detroit now. But places like Minneapolis also have been looking at streetcars. And that's just because there's sort of a general interest in what is exciting about what has happened in Portland, which has been a lot of people taking the streetcar, a lot of new development around that line. But in the case of Milwaukee, the city was able to actually receive a federal grant to help pay for the project. And that has made it possible to actually move forward with the construction of the line.
The construction of the line, as someone who lives in Milwaukee, in the heart of Milwaukee, has been really difficult. It's really torn up all of the streets kind of everywhere. It's made the city really difficult to navigate at the moment. And a lot of people are asking, will this be worth it? When we look at these same projects in other cities, has it been worth it? Has it created development?
You know, that is a really interesting question, and I don't think there's any single answer to that. I think there are situations where streetcars have been, according to the people who live in those places, projects that they really appreciate and that have changed the look and feel and use of the cities. And there have been other places where the streetcars, frankly, have not lived up to the expectations that people had for them originally. One example of that is in Washington, D.C., where the streetcar line was built along a street where there was an active bus and where the streetcar actually is significantly slower than the bus that came before it and doesn't allow actually easy connections with the Metrorail subway that Washington, D.C. has. And so in that case, you know, a lot of people would argue that that wasn't necessarily the best investment for the city as a whole. On the other hand, you know, in places like Kansas City, the streetcar has been incredibly popular, and people have used it for lots of trips between touristic destinations, especially on the weekends. And it's become a sort of activity that has been a pride of the city, attracting, you know, sometimes more than 10,000 people per day on that line. And so if Milwaukee is able to do something similarly, it could be something that's positive for the future of the city. Now, in terms of construction, that's certainly something that is a concern for any city that's investing in public works. But to be honest, it's kind of unavoidable. If you ever want to make an investment in improved transportation of any sort, you're going to unfortunately need to tear up the street and change the neighborhoods around it.
Well, in looking at the neighborhoods around the Milwaukee streetcar, we're already looking at an area which has some of the highest rents in the city. It's really rooted in the heart of downtown and doesn't really go that far outside of the center of the city. Where I live, which is right outside of downtown, is about as far as it goes. Is it common for streetcars to have a very limited route like this?
Yes. In the cities where streetcars have been implemented around the country, because of the limited amount of money available, they have generally been very short. The only city that has built a new streetcar system where the system is actually quite long is Portland. And that's because they've had streetcars in operation since, I believe 2001. Now, I agree with you that certainly Milwaukee's line as currently being constructed is quite short. It only connects the intermodal station, through the center of downtown and then a little north of downtown, as you said, onto Ogden Avenue. I don't think that that's necessarily a negative thing, especially if the system is planned to be expanded into the future. One great expansion of the streetcar in Milwaukee, for example, could be connecting it up to the University of Wisconsin. But that will require more investment and more time.
When I was talking to some colleagues, they noted that in European countries, they often have streetcars in their larger cities, but it seems like they operate a little differently. And some of the issues that I had taking the streetcar were things that they said really weren't issues in other countries. What can make a streetcar system more efficient, and what sort of impedes its ability to be functional?
So what's interesting about European cities is that they refer to their streetcars as tramways, and they are similar in some ways to the streetcars that are being built in places like Milwaukee, but they have some very important differences that make them more useful. And this comes down to the difference between streetcars and light rail that I described previously. So in the United States, streetcars are relatively small, not too much longer than a long bus, and they operate in lanes shared with traffic. On the other hand, in places like France, when new tramways are constructed, they are provided with services where the streetcars themselves are much longer. They're, the length of three or four buses. They also operate on lanes that are independent of traffic. And so the result is that they are significantly faster, two or three times faster, to get around the cities where they are used. I think the final most important element of the way tramways or streetcars are implemented in Europe is that they're implemented as part of a broader public transportation plan in the regions where they are built. For example, the major tramway project that's been built in Paris is a circular line that goes all around the city. And basically, it allows people to connect between existing metro subway lines without having to go to the center of the city. It allows people to transfer that way. One of the problems with a lot of the streetcars that are being thought of in the U.S. is that they're being designed as if all you do to take the public transportation system is ride the streetcar. In reality, a streetcar system should be designed as a way for people to use the whole public transportation network. It should allow people to connect to the bus system much more effectively. It should allow people to connect to the rail system if it exists already. And that's being done to some degree in Milwaukee with the connection to the intermodal station. But if you think about the route of the bus rapid transit line, which is proposed in Milwaukee, the east-west line, it's not really connected to the streetcar in a very serious way. The two are not designed together. On the other hand, the streetcar is designed as sort of a tourist approaching thing. And as a result, it won't get much ridership. It won't be very quick. And, for locals like you, it may not be the most effective way to get around.
All right. Well, Yonah Freemark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your expertise.
Thank you. I'm happy to help.
Yonah Freemark is the creator of The Transport Politic, a website that tracks and analyzes transportation projects around the world. He's also a PhD student in city planning at MIT, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers via Skype.
With a week remaining to see the Radas collection at the Museum of Wisconsin Art, we'll take a road trip to meet the family member responsible for preserving her family's legacy. Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For the better part of a century, one Wisconsin family amassed a collection of fashion and other artifacts whose cultural legacy gives us a glimpse of a particular strata of American society that doesn't normally get the spotlight.
All summer, the Museum of Wisconsin Art has showcased the clothes of six generations of the Radas family, who lived an upper-middle-class life in Marshfield. Jane Bradbury has been the driving force behind cataloging and preserving her family's collection of not only clothing, but of letters and other objects. She now lives in London, but she was back in Wisconsin in August to give some talks about the Wisconsin side of her family. I met her at the museum to learn more.
Augusta Radas, in whose house all these clothes were found, was my aunt, And she was almost like a second mother to me. So her house in Marshfield, Wisconsin was the homestead. And although I was born and raised in Boston, I used to go there every year, at least once a year, spend a lot of time there. And that house really was my roots. And as I lost my own mother quite young, she was like a substitute mother for me.
Now, when you came here to visit, did you know these clothes existed when you were a girl? Had you seen them? Were you one of those girls that went into the attic and, like, tried on grandma's clothes?
Well, I would have loved to, but when I was a little girl playing up on that top floor, the walk-in closet that they called the attic was locked most of the time. However, when I was 19, I will never forget when she brought me up there, took down a large brown box, and took out this black dress that was bought by my namesake, Jane Prindle Gammon, in Paris in 1880. And she gave it to me to try on. I could actually get into that. I could fasten up those whalebones. And suddenly I felt transformed. And I felt connected to her and also to her niece, who I'd seen photographs posing in this dress. So suddenly I was connected with these people. And I felt I could almost hear carriages, you know? It was just an incredible experience. And I felt like a different person myself. So I really date my interest in historic dress to that moment, trying on that dress.
Now, did you know all of these other clothes were up there, or
no,
did you?
No, I didn't. I'd seen some of them. So really, I didn't. She didn't take me up in the attic very much after that. And it was really almost 40 years later, in 2010, when she was getting quite old, and we started having to look and see what was in the house. So I started looking through and trying to sort things out a little bit and see what was there. So there were men's clothes, women's, children's, all different dates. I couldn't undo all the trunks, but I had a peek, and I was amazed. All the hats and the hat boxes made me think about what was life like for women when they had to put all these outfits together with hats and gloves.
So many layers.
And the layers. And I remember being up there late one night, and I got a glimpse of some black and some fur, and I looked around, and on the back of the door was a full-length black velvet evening coat lined with white ermine fur. And I thought to myself, oh, hello, is this what women are wearing in a small town, Wisconsin? So it was incredible. I knew there was a lot of history here. And I also rummaged around and found other things, like a playbill from Broadway in 1916. I dated it because of a car that was being advertised. So I knew there was a lot of stuff. I didn't know the extent. And so that's when I started to think, this really has to be investigated. There's a lot of fashion history here, but there's a lot of social history.
Was your aunt able to tell you anything at that point, or had she gotten too old to be able to talk?
She was quite old, but I remember taking this dress by Gladys Parker. So she couldn't get up the stairs anymore, but I would take this down carefully, and other dresses, I say, what do you remember about this? And she said, ah, yes, that was my favorite dance dress in college. She went to Northwestern University in Chicago, so she remembered this quite well. And she was interested. I found in letters she tried to find out about the designer, as you know, much later in 1950. She wrote somebody in New York, and they said, oh, no, never heard of her. Well, of course, she was actually very important at the time, but it's only through this label and the research that Edward and I did that now she's known about again.
Now, when did you and Edward meet and start working on this kind of thing?
So, as I said, in 2010, I had a feeling that there was something really serious here that needed to be investigated. It probably was worthy of being in a museum or becoming a book. So I thought, what is I'm going to do here? But I had saved many of her letters going back for many years to me, beautiful typewritten letters with family stories and everything. And in it, she describes some visits from Edward. And so she had his full name and his middle initial. So where did I go? Google. And I found him. So I communicated with him. And then when she died in early 2011, I invited him to come out, and that's when we started together to go through it one by one. And I expected there to be gaps. I was amazed that there were really quite few gaps. We had some things from the 1800s, and then from 1900 on, we found examples from every single decade of the 20th century.
Why do you think they wanted to save it? I mean, obviously no one was wearing it at the time. It was behind that locked door on the in the attic floor. What do you think they were holding on to it for?
It's a combination of things. First of all, they were very devoted to family. And so these were keepsakes. They brought back memories of past loved ones. But they also brought back memories for my aunt, like this prom dress here. She was the junior prom queen in 1932. It was the depths of the Depression. She got a new dress. She knew it was absolutely in fashion. She knew she looked fantastic. She remembered even how much it cost, 1995. And so this must have brought back amazing memories for her. So it was personal memories, memories of her family, and then also they were very patriotic and they loved history, particularly American history. So she once gave me a 1920s coat of my grandmother's. And she said, well, you can wear it once in a while, but be careful with it because, you know, these things get more and more interesting every year. She was just interested in everything, and she could just see, oh, isn't that incredible that they wore that when? And she wanted to show these things to other people. So she would have, you know, ladies' parties. She had different women's groups. They would get together. They would wear some of these things then, and they would admire the workmanship and the lace of what was being done at the turn of the century and later. So sometimes they actually did have kind of fashion shows.
I was wondering if they'd actually put them on later.
Yeah, somebody in Marshfield contacted me after I'd started the project and said, we found a fashion show, they called it a style show, done in 1988 for the DAR. And my aunt was the narrator wearing a dress from 1856 that she could actually get into. And a few of the dresses of her family were shown then, and other women brought their dresses too. The Broaddus's were not the only people. In fact, I have a feeling that whether it's Marshfield or Wisconsin, there's much more saving than you'd expect. So this dress, we found out from that video, she said, well, I wore this dress in college.
This is the one with a lovely asymmetrical.
Yes, this is the one on the cover of the book. So she wore this at college, a bit far from blue jeans and a sweatshirt, I think. And it was also bias cut, like the prom dress. And she said, if you could wear a bias cut dress, you were it. And she was it. I mean, she did have a beautiful figure, as you can gather. But what's so interesting about this, she didn't say that in this style show, but we have different evidence that we think this was made by her mother. And the thing about this collection is that because we had 10,000 letters in the house, 2,000 photographs, an incredible amount of artifacts, we could do some sleuthing and kind of figure out things. So there was a letter from this period from her mother to her when she was at college saying, well, I've gone through McCall's pattern books and I found some of these numbers. I want you to look at them. If you want me to make any of them for you when you come home from vacation, I will. So we know that she was sewing during the Depression, certainly. We also found a cutting from a Chicago Sunday paper. Great big cutting in color, and it was the French styles of 1934. And there was a coat with a collar just like this, made by Jean Patou, couturier in Paris. And they'd saved that very carefully. Why, we have to ask. Also, in my grandmother's room, I found a sewing book from 1931, and it was modern dressmaking, how to achieve French chic and smartness in dress. And it said, if you want to have beautiful clothes, you've got to make them yourself. You have to sew for style. And so all those things made us wonder. And then finally, it was a mistake. You see these little button loops here?
Yes.
They're supposed to go away from you, but they go towards you. And that's a mistake. No manufacturer would have done that. But maybe a woman sewing at home with children running around could have done that.
And so, just not noticed until it was too late.
Yeah, exactly. So they are the wrong way. So we don't know for sure. And it's possible that my aunt wouldn't have advertised that her mother was sewing because, you know, her mother was quite a matriarch of the town. And certainly in the Depression, she wouldn't have told people she was sewing because that might have been destabilizing for them because about 500 families were depending on the family business, the Rodas family business, for their own livelihoods. And so if they thought she was too much of a pinch to be sewing, that might have worried them. So, you know, maybe they just wanted to keep that quiet.
To themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. The idea that they had to economize as well might have been, as you say, destabilizing. Exactly.
So maybe they didn't want to advertise the fact. But she was known for her embroidery and things. But as I say, letters do prove that she was definitely sewing. And even in World War II, there's a letter saying, oh, I'm having trouble with the dress. So she was still sewing a little bit then, too.
Of all of the garments that are here in this exhibition, is there one particular one that you keep getting drawn to?
Well, I do love the prom dress very much, but this blue dress, which is also possibly by Catherine, Edward found a McCall's pattern very similar. I think this is fabulous. If I had to choose one dress that I would like, it's this one. And in fact, Edward has made a pattern for this. So one of my dreams is to actually produce it so I could actually sell a pattern because I think you could wear this today. The drapes are very Hollywood. We've seen pictures of Hollywood stars then wearing dresses with these long drapes. So it is very glamorous.
Is this the one that's made of three pieces of fabric or two pieces of fabric?
Yes. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And it's just artfully draped.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like one seam or
Like that, yes.
Yeah, it's a beautiful dress. And the color is gorgeous, too.
And the fact that she could, you know, choose just the right fabric, because this is a satin crepe and it has a lot of weight. So these aren't going to flap around. They're going to just hang beautifully. And by the way, we found a letter from 1941, and my aunt brought this to New Orleans, hoping to wear it to a Mardi Gras ball. And her aunt did not allow her to wear it. No, that wasn't appropriate, and she had to wear something else. And she writes in her diary, oh, I'm just so mad I have to wear this dress when I could look so basically gorgeous in my blue satin crepe. And she's obviously referring to this one. I studied this a little bit and talked to people from New Orleans, and I think it's because unmarried women then were not expected to show their bare shoulders. That wasn't quite right, and it was very kind of glamorous, and it just wasn't quite appropriate, at least not according to her aunt, so she couldn't wear this gorgeous dress.
It's interesting because, of course, the neckline is high because of the way the draping works. So you don't have the décolletage.
But most of her shoulder would have been showing.
And her arms. Yeah.
And her arms, yeah. Yes.
Well, all of this has been put together in a book, and I understand, just found out today, that you've won an award for the book.
Yes.
Congratulations. Thank
you. Amazingly, yes. A few months ago, we were at the Costume Society of America conference in Maine, and they awarded us the Milia Davenport Publication Award, which is given to what they consider to be the finest dress history book of 2017. So it's a great, great honor. We can take credit, but I think a lot of the credit goes to all the women in my family who saved all these things. It was quite a string of women who were saving it and recognizing that they told something about the past and all the artifacts as well and all the letters. It was a very unusual project, and so I think they recognized that. And
in our era of everyone wanting to be minimal and, you know, the idea of just clearing out and having only one or two things, what we would have lost if they had thought that way.
Absolutely. In fact, I found something that my aunt wrote, and she said, I can't throw away a letter because to me it's like throwing away a part of a person. Well, that's why there were 10,000 letters in this house. But that's, I think, how she felt a little bit about the clothes as well. They represented people, her own life and people she loved. And they represented American history.
Well, Jane, I want to thank you so much for taking
thank
time.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you very much indeed.
Jane Bradbury is the niece of the late Augusta Roddice of Marshfield, Wisconsin, and the curator of her family's cultural legacy. The Roddice collection is on view for another week at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend, and you can learn more at WUWM.com.
We'll take a break now and then hear about the other fashion exhibition, which is wrapping up at the museum when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we heard from Jane Bradbury, the woman responsible for the Roddice Collection exhibition at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. The exhibition was part of a summer-long group of shows dedicated to Wisconsin fashion. Three of those four shows focused on adult fashion, but the fourth exhibition looks at the legacy of an influential Milwaukee designer of high-end children's clothing, Florence Eisman.
Eisman started her iconic company in 1945, and by 1955, she'd won a prestigious Neiman Marcus Fashion Award for her designs that are credited for creating the look of the modern child. The company is still very much in business.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Sarah Carter, curator and director of research for the Chipstone Foundation, tells contributor Jennifer Fields about creating the retrospective exhibit, Florence Eisman, Designing Childhood for the American Century.
Most of the exhibition projects that we work on, you start in a library, or you start in an archive. In this case, we started in the factory. So we're quite fortunate that Florence Eisman LLC actually has kept hundreds of garments throughout most of their company history. So we were able to go through those garments and begin to make sense of them. They're not sorted at this point as a traditional archive would, because the company is so interested in history that those garments continue to be used as design inspiration today. They've also saved a number of really amazing scrapbooks from the company's history that helped us. Then we also took a trip to Mount Mary, which has a really excellent fashion collection. And we were able to look at a number of early pieces, early Florence Eisman pieces in their collection that have been donated to Mount Mary. So with those two collections as our starting point, we began to piece together a chronology, and we began to look for key themes that we could pull out of those garments that could help us tell some interesting stories. And that's how we began to think about this post-war periodization as being important. And we began to think about a number of different themes that could help us really begin to tell the story of Florence Eisman. Because even though we've written a whole catalog on this topic, the story is still just beginning to unfold. And there are more stories that any one of these garments could tell us.
So then you look at this as a living exhibit. This is something that you will continue to, in some shape or form, add to, work on, continue to build up and flesh out those narratives.
One of the things that's been so exciting with this project is that it very much is a living exhibit. People come into the gallery, they might hear me give a lecture, and they immediately want to tell me their stories. And they want to share their objects, and they want to share their family photographs that have every one of their kids and grandkids wearing a Florence Eisman dress. I've had people telling me stories like, you know, in the 1950s, I wanted to dress my daughter in beautiful Florence Eisman clothes because I was a working mom, and that let everyone know she was well taken care of. I've had other people say they love the factory sales so much that they would bring a little piece of string with them so that they could see exactly how big their child was in comparison to the garments there for sale, to make sure they could get a garment that their child could wear this year so they wouldn't have to wait two more years for him to wear the cute little shortalls. These objects really resonate with people because they connect to their lives, to their families' lives, and they also connect to Milwaukee. I mean, this is a Milwaukee company.
This really does pull you in a sense that not only does it pull you in through the eyes, your eyes as an adult, but it then takes you back to that childhood period. And if you're lucky enough to have had one, it would have been most likely tied to a special event. Your Easter dress, your Christmas dress, your family photo dress.
I have that same experience here. I mean, there are dresses I look at, and I think of my next-door neighbor who used to wear dresses like that, and we would go to Teddy Bear Tees every year around Christmas. I mean, it's a very emotional, visceral connection to these objects that even though I can study them as a scholar, as a historian, I also have to connect them as a person who have memories of my own childhood. I connect them as a mother thinking about how difficult it was to try to get my son into a Florence Eisenman garment. These kinds of garments invite that personal connection, which is something that as a curator who often works on other materials, I'm always trying to develop and to create, to have someone connect to what we're displaying. But when you're dealing with children's clothing, and especially fantastic children's clothing, like the work that Florence Eisenman has been creating for 70 years now, it just happens. Those connections are just made. And as curators and designers, we've been able to facilitate those connections in some interesting ways, hopefully.
What I liked about it, Sarah, is that I know you gave a lecture downstairs before we did this interview, and there were a number of women there. But when they came up here, while they may have been sitting in separate seats across the room from each other, we had to wait to do interviews because it was so loud in here. The cacophony, the stories, the connections that were made. I don't know that I've ever seen that sort of interaction in one exhibit ever before.
There was a real palpable excitement. And I think part of that comes from this realization that the things that these women experienced is the stuff of history, and it's culturally important, and they are participants in these historical patterns, and they have stories that we want to hear and that are valuable.
And particularly in a time where motherhood, when you're taking women who were out of the workforce or who were in the workforce during the World War II, bring them out of that workforce, there were women that continued to work and they faced judgments about working. Right. And this may have been a time period where you not only had the everyday stress of being a mom and being part of a family, but now you're facing these external judgments about how well you do your job.
And what's so powerful for me in terms of talking to many women about these garments is they give them a way to talk about some of those pressures. And whether that pressure is getting the perfect garment for your child, or for some women, they even talked about making Florence Eisenman clothes themselves, buying the fabrics and creating garments so that their children could have these garments as well. But thinking about how these garments might suggest both the pleasures and the pressures of motherhood and how those things so often go together. And also thinking about parents' roles in trying to create what some scholars have talked about as a sense of wondrous innocence for your children or childhood, creating a feeling of wonder. And that wonder could be having all of your children wearing matching clothes and having this very special moment on a family vacation or at the holidays where you're creating a beautiful image that you will treasure for years. Or that wonder could be having your child wear a dress that might have a whole range of funny aprons or pinafores that they could wear, like some of the really wonderful doll-shaped pinafores in the exhibition. But creating that sense of wonder is in some ways both a pleasure and a pressure of motherhood. And these clothes can help you begin to think about that complexity.
Talk to me about the design and the look of this exhibition.
We were quite fortunate to be able to work with Brent Budsberg, who's an amazing exhibition designer. And we took various historical cues to help us design different parts of the exhibition here at MOA. And what we're looking at here in this section is a room that is inspired by a presentation drawing made by Chicago architect and designer Henry P. Glass. And he created this for a Chicago fabric company, and it's a presentation design for a company selling tiny little children's clothes on forms in these wonderful, strange, amoeba-shaped shadow boxes and with this great mid-century inspired furniture and with this really interesting ceiling installation. And so what we were thinking about in selecting this as a design source is that we wanted visitors to feel like they were actually there in the 40s when Lawrence Eisenman and Florence Eisenman started selling these garments at Marshall Field's in Chicago. And there are several other moments like that throughout the exhibition where we're not just putting the clothes on display with labels, but we're trying to create an experience that invokes memories, that connects to the garments, that allows visitors to see them not just as works of art on the wall, but as garments that existed in a specific historical context. I think the women in this space felt welcomed in, and they felt that they could look closely and that they had something valuable to say about the garments on display, which of course they do. And these kinds of design interventions invite that sort of conversation, because we're really thinking about their experience. We're thinking about what it feels like to be in this space, and we are trying to make it feel comfortable, interesting. We're trying to transport them to another world, which is part of what museums do. They take you out of your daily life and they bring you somewhere else. And in this case, we are trying to invite visitors into an historical moment when they can look at these garments, think about these garments, connect, remember, and then think about how the things that they might have worn, that their children might have worn, or their grandchildren might have worn, or their aunt or niece or nephew might have worn, can connect them to some pretty big themes in American cultural history and American art history.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. That project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
We'll take one last break and then speak with the Milwaukee founder of a travel website aimed specifically at families. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you're planning a trip, there are dozens of glossy magazines and fancy websites that can help you refine your destination, from travel and leisure to afar to National Geographic Traveler and many specialty publications. But if you're trying to plan a trip that includes children, there are far fewer options with content specifically geared toward traveling with a family.
A Milwaukee woman is the founder of a website that seeks to compile and curate just that sort of information. Andrea Kahn describes herself as the chief travel officer of the Family Backpack, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So on one level, the definition of family travel seems pretty straightforward, you know, places where you might go with your young or adolescent children in tow. But aside from that pretty literal definition, is there a bigger picture that you're speaking to?
I think the bigger picture is that travel doesn't have to always mean hopping on a plane and heading overseas to Indonesia. Travel can be something that you experience even locally in your own city, getting out and experiencing it with a different perspective, a different set of eyes, taking a day trip. It's all about getting your kids out there to experience the world around them and expose them to as many things as you can.
What is it about travel that you think is so vital for a family as a whole, and for children in particular?
I think for a family as a whole, it allows you to create memories and experiences together. And when you ask kids, you know, 10, 15 years down the road, they're not going to remember the Barbie doll or the Lego set. They're going to remember that, you know, that trip you took up to the Apostle Islands. So I think that's the important part, one of the many reasons for family travel. I think for kids, though, it gives them a sense of the world, that there's more to just where they live. There's different cultures. There's different foods to try. So it really gives them those opportunities to see what else is around the world.
Well, what are your own travel memories that you harken back to when you were a kid?
Oh, gosh. I mean, one of my favorite is a trip out to Yellowstone, and we road trip. So we did the Badlands. We hit it all.
like the that back massive, of a station wagon?
You got it. Literally, Pontiac station wagon, road tripped all the way out west. And it was one of the most life-changing moments. I mean, seeing those Grand Teton Mountains once we made it out to the Jackson Hole. Actually, we went as far as Jackson Hole.
And you were how old?
I was in like 14 or 15 at that point. So, yeah, that's one of my favorite memories.
Do you think is there something about a trip when it's done right, that the way that the family coexists, that's different than when they're, you know, at home watching a movie on TV?
I think you have to interact on a much different level. And I also think what's really cool about travel is it gives kids an opportunity to see their parents and how they react in different situations. So, you know, how to navigate the metro in a new city like D.C. or Paris. How to, you know, when you travel in Europe and kind of off the beaten path, GPS might not always work so great. So you might actually have to get out an old school map. And so teaching your kids, like, how to use a map, which is such a novel idea at this point. So I really think it gives kids those opportunities, again, to see how their parents handle things in different situations. And it makes them more adaptable. You know, your flight's delayed by 2 hours. You know, how do you handle it? And what do you do, you know, in that situation?
So with all this in mind, how did it lead to the inspiration for this website?
Well, I have been traveling since a young age. I went to Europe for the first time in high school, and that was it. I've been bitten by the traveling bug ever since. I married a guy who loves to travel as well. And so we've been traveling as much as we possibly can with our kids. And I have logged a lot of hours online trying to research family vacations. And I just had this aha moment last summer that wouldn't it be great if the best of the travel, family travel advice out there was all in one website and, you know, easily searchable, so I wouldn't have to spend those 20 hours trolling on the internet myself. So that's where it came out of.
And obviously, what's right for some families does not work for others. Talk about navigating the site and making it work for you as a prospective traveler to a given destination.
Yeah, well, I think if you're planning a specific trip to a destination, the website's very easy. You just go in, you choose, you know, what continent, and then you can go down, like if it's North America, you can scroll and hit any state in the United States and then further segment by cities. We also have tabs where you can choose if you just want to do, you want eat, stay. So you can even segment further by that. And then once you've booked that travel, if you're more interested in packing tips or just general tips before you travel, we have sections that cover that as well.
How are you collecting the content?
We have a team of travel curators, moms and dads that have all traveled and obviously all have kids as well. We're curating it all manually, which is time consuming. But I really felt that that was the right way to go because an algorithm would have not captured, it wouldn't have funneled out everything. It would have funneled in everything and we wouldn't have gotten the best of the best. And that's what we're really striving for is we're trying to sift through all of that information so only the most important and the most relevant information makes it onto the site.
It feels a little bit, spending some time on it, a little bit like you're doing for family travel what Pinterest does for you. Maybe everything.
Yeah. Essentially, we are. You know, as a mom of three kids, and everyone that's involved in the site has kids as well. We really are modeling the site after what we think you know works and what we want to see and what's helpful to all of us. We're really trying to hit those pain points for parents. Again, we're all busy. We all have 300 things going on in our lives. So we're trying to cut down that time for parents, but still allow them the chance to feel like they spent some time planning a vacation.
How about the getting there part? Because that's, you know, you talk about the road trip that you took out west when you were 13 or 14 or what have you. And, you know, maybe we're talking about the Apostle Islands. These are places that, you know, you actually have to do some traveling to get to the point that you are traveling to. Do you get into the you know, how to make a road trip work concept?
Yeah, actually, there's lots of great posts under the Before You Travel section about making a road trip work and some of the best tips for that. There's also activities and game ideas, lots of different suggestions. And they're all written by family travel bloggers. So these are people that are living these experiences and then writing about them.
I'm sure the examples are too numerous to get into every one, but talk about traveling with your own family today and some places that you've had real success with and how that translates to what people read about.
Yeah, I think we did actually a big road trip ourselves this summer. We went out to Asheville, North Carolina and Charleston, South Carolina. And I think, you know, as a parent, it's just being overprepared. So, which gets to be exhausting at times, but the end result is worth it. And so it's making sure that you have, you know, plenty of snacks and activities to do in the car. And I love things like Pinterest. I mean, and we've created our own Pinterest boards to help people with printables for activities for kids to do in the car, for example. But I think it's that, you know, trying to think through every situation that could occur and being prepared for it. Or another great example, we were flying through an airport years ago when my daughter was a baby and she had a huge blowout as we were going through security. Good times. But I had packed, you know, two outfits. So, you know, in case there was another blowout, so I was prepared. So we got through security, hopped into the bathroom, changed her, you know, threw everything away, washed hands, and off we went. And so because I was overprepared for that situation, it didn't make the situation itself as stressful.
I imagine it was still a little stressful.
Well, it's embarrassing because everyone's looking at you because there's a strong smell and it's happening.
What has been the most rewarding aspect of doing this?
I think just, you know, seeing the responses and the reactions from families that have written us and contacted us and said, wow, you know, this site helped us so much. And then just having that that common connection on social media, like Instagram, for example, with other families that are traveling and share that same passion. I think it's so cool.
What is your background besides being, a huge travel fan and someone who went places as a kid growing up? What was your background that led you to wade into this?
Yeah, my previous life was in marketing. So I've worked for different brands like Dish Network and Kohl's Department Store. And then the last 8 years, I've spent home with the kids and done a lot of volunteer work, which always played into the marketing arena. Helped out some family with different things, my previous life is marketing, which helps in, you know, starting up a company like this.
One of the sections of this website is the bucket list, the travel bucket list. What is on your own family travel bucket list?
Gosh, it changes weekly, especially because I read so many blogs. I'm constantly changing what that list is, but I would say Japan is top, followed by Jordan. And then I would say Iceland is number three. That's outside the United States. Inside the United States, I'm actually dying to get up to the Apostle Islands. I've not been there yet. And Santa Fe, New Mexico is another one that is high on the bucket list for the U.S.
And what I didn't ask, are you also creating content? Are you writing about these places?
I am writing some original content. Like I said, we have traveled with the kids, and we did a really neat trip to Cuba earlier this year, which was really interesting. And so I've written about that and some of our other trips as well.
Well, I hope we can have you back to share some of these stories with us.
Yes, I would love to.
Well, Andrea Kahn, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Mitch.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Andrea Kahn is founder and chief travel officer of the website The Family Backpack. You'll find a link to it at wuwm.com. And that is the Monday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tite. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air is next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.